Broadcasting to New York City, Los Angeles, Chicago, Sydney, London, and around the world, this is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and we're online at kpcg.fm, live link at thetrumpet.com as well. Severe weather in the United States, actually some fatalities overnight. We've got details about that. Also, you'll love this story, a real-life 2-year-old superhero. It's pretty incredible what he did. Road rage is growing, and it's affecting a lot of people, including truck drivers. More details about that. And in Germany, you'll be surprised what the bestseller is. Maybe not. It's Mein Kampf. There you go. I already told you. Details about that and more. This edition, Trumpet Radio Live.
This is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live on 101.3 KPCG. We're online at kpcg.fm, live link at thetrumpet.com. And if you'd like to follow us on Twitter, you can do that at kpcgfm. Any emails, please send those to comments at kpcg.fm. I'm Dwight Falk, Grant Turgeon, and Abraham Blondeau here today. Greetings, one and all.
Yes, we've returned.
You're referring to yourself in the royal we, which is which is great.
I refer to myself in the plural third person.
The plural third. Yes, it's always interesting when that does happen. We sometimes occasionally joke that you can send us comments, of course, which that part's not a joke, but the joke would be that you can send us recipes. We actually got our first recipe. Somebody sent us a recipe. Based upon a story we talked about yesterday, we talked about a little bit of the secret menu at Starbucks, and somebody investigated and they found the link for it. StarbucksSecretMenu.net /Starbucks Secret Menu. And here's, they have the recipe for the, what do they call that thing?
The cough drop.
Cough drop, yeah. So get out a pencil and paper or just look it up online. Here's the recipe for it. You get yourself a venti cup with a bag of jade citrus mint tea and a bag of peach tranquility tea. Add half hot water and half steamed lemonade. Add a little honey, and then you can optionally put in a pump of peppermint. That's the secret recipe for the cough drop that you can order at Starbucks.
Those are some pretty exotic ingredients. I might just go ask Starbucks to do that for me.
Yeah, I don't think I've got a lot of peach tea sitting around, right, but somebody may.
Or steamed lemonade.
Yeah, we don't have a lot of steamed lemonade sitting around the house, as far as I know. But so anyway, there's a whole menu out there. StarbucksSecretMenu.net. I'm sure if you just Google that, you'll probably find the links you need. So it's out there. If you dare. to look that up and see what other drinks you might come up with or might be on the secret menu.
.net makes me think it might be a fake. Why is it not .com?
Those are questions that we're not going to answer in today's program. Maybe it is a fake. I don't know. But it sounds like it'd be good. So
yeah, it's there's a lot of things people have drank at Starbucks, and I have no idea what they're talking about. I mean, I don't really go to Starbucks that often anyway. But
you're a Tim Hortons guy from Canada.
Yeah. So it's
and there you just get coffee hot or really hot, right?
So yes, the two drinks. Or with ice shaped like a polar bear floating in it. I guess In-N-Out, the burger place that has a hidden menu as well, right?
From what does it? Huh.
I've heard that too.
People order things and they're, because they only have like three options.
Oh, I see.
But people order things not on the menu. I'm like, well, how did you know that?
Yeah, who are you talking to? Yeah. How do you know about the hidden? Why is it hidden? Just tell everybody what's on there.
Yeah, exactly. Because most people order what's not on the menu anyway, so it's a little confusing to me.
There was, well, today here in Edmond, Oklahoma City area, it is cold and windy, rainy, kind of a, I don't know, yucky day in a way. We had a nice day yesterday. It was almost 70, but it's colder today. So we had a warm front, now a cold front, and that affected some areas. Severe storms sweep across southern states, leaving at least five dead. Five people were killed Monday night as a powerful storm system swept across the southern states, leaving a trail of destruction. The line of severe thunderstorms spawned several possible tornadoes, and the threat remained early Tuesday for southern Alabama, southwest Georgia, and Florida Panhandle. So it seems kind of weird to have those types of storms this time of year, but I guess it does happen. And five killed. A mobile home had a tree fall on it. It is always a mobile home. It seems like no matter what, it's when it comes to a tornado.
Yeah, it's I think that's, for whatever reason, seems like mobile homes are most popular in states where there are a lot of tornadoes.
Yeah.
Which seems a little, I don't know, like the opposite of what you want to do. Things that can move and are somewhat flimsy under compared to a regular house. Not all mobile homes, but just seems to me like an odd kind of cultural phenomenon in the middle of Tornado Alley. We don't really see New Year's Eve, Christmas storms that often, but seems like last few years there have been quite a few.
Yeah, the majority of the people, like I mentioned, were killed when a tree fell on their mobile home. That was in Alabama. And then one of the fire chiefs said that a fireworks stand in the Walmart parking lot was tossed 30 or 40 yards and mangled. The storm also knocked over an 18-wheeled truck trailers and punched holes in the Walmart's roof. And people were still shopping. They wouldn't leave. It was getting torn apart, and they were like, well, we're here. I guess we might as well do our shopping. Probably safer in there than some places.
Yeah. Yes, usually it's better to stay where you are in a severe storm than travel out trying to get home or wherever else.
I guess that's the kind of the conundrum. If you're in the store, do you just go to a safe spot or just keep shopping? Keep on shopping.
Be productive.
Fill up your cart. Looking for the secret Walmart storm menu that nobody knows about. Where's the secret storm products? So anyway, that was still some potentiality for storms today. In those areas. I was talking to somebody yesterday, actually. We have some people in town here at Herbert W. Armstrong College. There's a weekend going on, kind of a get-together. And somebody from Canada that said, they were talking about how much snow there was driving down. Feet and feet of snow. They're 8-foot banks. We've got nothing down here. So he was mentioning how they had to go a different route because there's too much snow. They actually closed part of an interstate, and they had to go 6 hours out of their way just so they could avoid it. So we don't have a lot to complain about down here in the Oklahoma area. A little chilly, but hey, we don't have 8 feet of snow. So
someone was also telling me that there was a big issue even up in Kansas City with airport closings, and that was at the time when we've been having the 60-degree, 50-degree weather, and just 5 hours east, northeast of us, there's a huge issue there as well.
Winter weather, you never know what you're going to get. Unless you're up north, then you know you're going to get snow. this is an amazing, amazing story from Fox News, and the video is on the Fox website, so check this out. This is like a real-life superhero here. 2-year-old boy pushes dresser off his twin brother, who is stuck underneath. So this happens a lot with kids. You have to be careful. They want to climb up the top of the dresser, and they pull out the drawers to do it. And as they climb up, they tip it over. That happens a lot of times. So the parents are downstairs. And they didn't know this all happened. They saw it later in the surveillance footage. The two twin boys, 2 years old apiece, and they pull out the drawers and they start climbing, tips over, pins the one underneath. So that can happen. So they put it up kind of like a warning, like, hey, look at what can happen. You know, be careful about that. Ever happened to you guys? Ever do that?
No, we never really had anything we could climb in terms of furniture that was top heavy or tall. So, we never really had something like that happen to us growing up.
Yeah, well, good, because it can be super dangerous. So this happened. The dresser falls over on the one twin boy, and they're in their PJs. They got the little onesie PJs on. And the other boy is not trapped. And so the guy that's not trapped, 2 years old, keep in mind, he pushes the dresser off of the other one. He just pushes it across the room. They have the video on Fox News. It's amazing. I mean, I don't know how much it weighs. But a 2-year-old child, I mean, he can barely stand up, and he pushes a dresser off of his brother. Probably, I don't know if he saved his life, but he definitely, you know, prevented further injury.
That sounds like, I guess they talk about mothers when they have the strength to lift a car off of their baby and things like that. And I didn't know that applied to a 2-year-old boy, but apparently he really loves his twin brother.
Well, just the fact that he'd be smart enough to say, I'm going to move this. I need to move this. Mm-hmm. And then they had the strength to do it. I found that just astounding. I mean, like I said, I don't know if it was full or not, but it was a pretty good size dresser. And who knows? On the lightest, it would have been, what, probably 30, 40 pounds, I'm guessing. for a 2-year-old to move that and just, that's amazing.
That's probably his weight, at least.
Oh, I would, more. Yeah, yeah, I would think. If you look at the video, you'll see it. So, really cool video. The parents said that they almost didn't put it up, but they actually put it up as kind of a warning to other people that you got to be careful with that. And then it was so cool that he pushed it off of his brother. His brother owes him a big one.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm sure he'll remind him many times. Remember when I saved your life with my superhuman strength?
It looks like we discovered the next Captain America.
Well, I was actually thinking about that. I'm like, oh, maybe he's got like some sort of super strength. I mean, the parents said, you know, in their little write-up that, you know, they think he had like an angel helped him or something. And I mean, I don't know. Things like that could happen. Mm-hmm. So pretty cool story. And again, you can find the video at Fox News. And it's worth seeing. It's a pretty neat video. Speaking of twins, there were twins born in different years delivered in Florida this year. I always love it when that happens. It's always a great trivia question for people, or I don't know how you pose the question, but I mean, you know, something to talk about for the rest of your life. You know, we're twins, but we're born in different years, 18 minutes apart. So
very end of December 31st, yeah. Very beginning of January 1st.
Yeah, I think that's cool.
Yeah, that's always a good conversation starter.
And yeah, and you can always hold it over your twin too. I mean, you're older than you. You don't know what you're talking about. I've lived. You haven't.
They shouldn't even be legally classified as twins at that point.
Yeah, it's. I guess I don't know what the like how long between the two births it would be before you wouldn't be. I guess you'd always be considered twins no matter what because.
Oh yeah, because you were in the womb together. But it's still funny that they're still born in separate years, even still.
Yeah, it's really weird.
Yeah, that'd be a rough New Year's Eve for that mother.
No revelry for her.
Yeah, you'd always the one could always say to the other, I remember back in 2016, you weren't alive back then, but quite a rough year. Donald Trump got into office. All kinds of things happened. So one of the big stories last week was this situation with the Russia hacking the election, apparently, if you were to believe what everybody says. And then the retribution for it, which was expelling 35, I think it was, Russian diplomats from the U.S. But even then, I was like, well, how do we know they did that, though? Like, everybody just said, well, they did it, and there's proof, but they didn't say what it was. So still don't know, but Julian Assange of WikiLeaks, he's the one that put the documents out from the DNC. And now he's come out and told Fox News' Sean Hannity that Russia didn't have anything to do with it. Now, he won't say where he got it from, but he says Russia had nothing to do with it. So, and he's saying that he thinks they're just trying to discredit Donald Trump. I mean, do you believe Julian Assange? I would tend to kind of, because he's released legitimate documents to this point. But it's just interesting. I would like to see, I guess, personally, just more proof that they did something if we're going to go after Russia.
Yeah, and I think I've heard him briefly mention that a couple other times where he said, wait a second, no one is saying that Russia did it. Where are you getting your information? He keeps on saying it, and the liberals keep saying, oh, Russia! Like, they keep catastrophizing about it. Like, that is absolutely the problem.
And it
really
sounds like that, too.
It doesn't sound like. Yeah.
Yes.
That pitch.
Russia!
So it's interesting. And he said that... he was asked if he thought President Obama was lying to the American people about Russia's actions. Assange said the president is acting like a lawyer with his allegations. Oh. He's alleging things, but where's the proof?
Yeah. Well, President Obama.
If he's like a lawyer.
Yeah. I think that's what he's getting at, right? Yeah.
Well, President Obama is a lawyer.
Right.
So this is right up his alley. It's interesting that... that he comes out and speaks about this, and I think whether Russia did it or not, they are getting their way by distracting everyone with this. It's still important. We should figure out what happened. But the amount of hacks and other nations, like especially China, who have disrupted American computer systems and everything in the past, and this is the moment we decide to take a stand on it when... there have been far greater breaches of security. It's whether Russia did it or not, it's obviously a very politicized moment which the Democrats are taking an advantage of.
Yeah, I felt like last week when it came out, I felt like it was a personal vendetta going after them. And it didn't seem like I think we mentioned last week, if you're going to make a strong stand against Russia, probably pick a better time to do it, or something with a little more teeth in it than just this personal, you know, I'm mad at you because of these emails. At least that's the way it seemed to me. So, and they have come out and said, well, it didn't affect the results of the election, but the implication is that it did. You know what I mean? So it does seem like, I do think Assange is probably right here, that they are trying to delegitimize Trump's presidency.
And like we always say, too, they only just now are starting to care about communist infiltration or Russian infiltration, right, when they have been corrupting our education system and really every system in this country for 40, 50 years.
Yeah, it's an interesting time to make the big move. So interesting. That's from Fox. Assange says Russian government not the source of the WikiLeaks emails. He's got to be careful. He can't say who his sources are. So who's telling him?
He has a dangerous life, too. He's holed up, isn't it, in a Swedish embassy, I think. But he really can't even leave the room. And I think he's even been advised to stay away from the windows or stay off the balcony in case anyone tries to kill him, because I think the windows are actually bulletproof.
Yeah, he is definitely in a dangerous situation. And you'd have to even worry about what you're eating and drinking and stuff, mm-hmm. You know. Hey, somebody dropped off a hamburger for you. Where'd it come from? Feed it to the dog first, see what happens.
I think his internet was actually cut off in the embassy recently, and it almost drove him crazy because it's like he's in there all day. Yeah. He has nothing else to do except for maybe go online.
Yeah, that's right. I think we'd all go crazy if we didn't have the internet. We'd have to talk to each other. speaking of, hey, that ties in directly to our next story, and I didn't even plan it that way. It's all coming together. And you'll like this one, Grant. Year-long digital detox left a woman feeling grateful for every moment. Wow. You've done a little detox, digital. Not yes. for a year, right?
No, but I've done it for a month several times.
And you've liked it. You've liked the results. Well, this is a Washington, D.C. woman. She revealed that a year-long digital detox from Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and Snapchat has left her feeling grateful for every moment. I don't know that she got off of everything, but she got off of these platforms, Facebook, Twitter, mm-hmm. Instagram, and Snapchat. Her name is Darla Bunting, and she said she had hundreds of Facebook and Snapchat friends, over 1,300 Instagram followers, more than 4,000 Twitter followers. But on January 1st last year, she announced in a blog post, I missed the memo, that she was giving up the sharing platforms for the next 365 days. The education advocate told ABC News last year that she initially deleted the social media apps for a month on the advice of her pastor, but found the mini digital detox wasn't enough. Now, after doing it for an entire year, she's 31 years old, she says, I had different epiphanies over the course of this year, and I feel much more at peace. She said, when I began to cut out different things, I learned to have an attitude of gratitude. And she said that she gained learning how to quiet her own thoughts and own opinions and listen to other people. That's what she thinks she gained from it, instead of getting on Facebook and arguing. And she said she didn't lose any friends over the election because she wasn't on there.
Good point.
So anyway, she liked it. She said it gave her more peace of mind.
Yeah, I think that's a good story for all of us to read and just to think about. What we value in life and spend our time on, because a lot of the times things that get us worked up or things we get upset about or what we just seem to gravitate towards, a lot of the time can be just the trivial posts on Twitter or Facebook or reading something online that gets us pretty upset or arguing with someone over the on the digital battlefield about something on YouTube that's really inconsequential. But when you take a step back and just unplug yourself and look at your life and your family and those things which we all probably think are much more important and spend your time on those, I think you start to realize just how a human being is supposed to behave. And a lot of these distractions can really alter our lifestyles and our behaviors.
Yeah, you can lose yourself in a digital world, sort of. Get sucked in like those, I don't know, I'm sure there's been movies about it. We get sucked into the computer. It kind of has happened, right?
Yeah.
Not physically in most cases, but certainly, well, in any case, but but certainly takes up your time and your effort and a lot of things and it affects your emotions and a lot of that. So anyway, might be something to try.
Yeah, I would highly recommend it. Just putting away the personal screen. I still have to use a computer for work anyway, but Whenever I do the detox, I just put the phone away, and I'm not allowed to even look at it once over the course of the entire month. I might even give it to a friend to keep it and say, like, even if I demand it back this particular day, don't give it back to me until the end of the month.
Isn't that amazing? I mean, it really is like a drug, sort of, mm-hmm. to where you, like, you know, don't give this to me, hide it. Because you want to look and see. You know, it's interesting. There's a story today. I forget if it's on the Daily Mail or Mirror or one of those out of the UK. These people in this prison over there somewhere in the UK, they had phones, and they started like an Instagram account or something, and they were putting up pictures and so forth of their party inside the jail on Christmas, which for them meant doing drugs and having boxing matches. And they're in prison, and they have a social media account. And they're just in there doing all this stuff. It's like, what is this? And so anyway, that's just, I mean, if people in prison have social media accounts, wow, it's everywhere.
Yeah, it's ubiquitous. You can't escape it hardly unless, like I said, you give it to a friend. I've given it to my dad before, and he's put it in his desk drawer and locked it in there for a month. I've given it to a friend at college before. And because it's like, if you've gone without it for three weeks, you start to invent some reasons why you might actually need to check it. But really, it's not that crucial because people can always contact you in other ways. That's the thing to realize.
Have you found that it's harder, you know, the first few days, weeks, and then after that, you just kind of enjoy not having it? Or is it always sort of a temptation to...
I actually think it's always enjoyable. It's not like I'm ever longing to have it back. It's just like I might panic for a second that someone really important was trying to call me. And it's really never the case. It's just an imagination thing.
Yeah, it's we're so used to it. It is a little. Yeah, I mean, I know how you feel. If you go somewhere and you're like, "Hey, where's my phone?" You know,
yeah.
No one's trying to get a hold of me, but still, for some reason, mm-hmm. feel like it has to be right there.
Yeah, I think also even just not having it in your pocket, you don't have to make hundreds of conscious decisions every day not to pull it out for no reason, because it's not there. That's not even an option. You don't have to exercise all that extra decision-making power to avoid taking it out when you don't need to.
Yeah, simplifies things for sure. Of course, this next one's happening. Controversial McDonald's opens in Vatican City amid cardinal protests. Ronald McDonald has officially joined the Pope in Vatican City, they say. Despite a very public battle waged by locals and religious officials to keep the fast food chain out of the papal headquarters, a branch of the Golden Arches chain restaurant opened for business on Friday, just feet away from St. Peter's Square. So, if you want to stop by the Golden Arches on your way to the Pearly Gates, now you can do so. They're upset about it. Some people are.
It's strange how today people get upset about things like that, and yet the other things that go on in that church are a lot less savory than having a McDonald's nearby.
They say the establishment, open 6 days a week from 6:30 a.m. to 11 p.m., is located on the ground floor in a Vatican-owned building about 100 yards from the Pope's home, so he can go get a burger, too. Some cardinals complained about not being consulted prior to the restaurant's construction, directly above the new Italian home of the Big Mac. Well, here's the thing that's kind of interesting about this here, this next quote, and then this fact that follows. Cardinal Elio Scrigicia, ballpark, I don't know if I got that right. He was upset about this. He says, selling mega sandwiches in this area is a disgrace. He said the money could be better spent on helping the area's homeless population. The area is needy and suffering, as the Pope teaches, he said. Okay, whatever.
That sounds like a racket in the making. Just give the money to the Catholic Church and they'll redistribute it to the poor people.
Well, listen to this, though. Here's the next thing. The Vatican is set to collect a monthly rent of $33,000 from that McDonald's because it's on Vatican-owned property. I'm like, well, your problem's solved. You could take all the rent money, you could feed all the homeless, and they could eat at McDonald's. You could solve all the problems right there. It's, you know, it's one thing to say, well, people shouldn't spend their money on them. But even if they don't spend it there, they'll spend it on the one down the road, so right. It makes no difference. But they're making $33,000 a month, so just pay that money back out.
Yeah. Well, I don't agree with putting commercialized things in historical sites, and you can say Vatican City's historical site. So maybe from that angle, I can see why people could be upset about it. But if you're just arguing from a financial standpoint, let's look at the Catholic Church. they have, they're one of the most wealthiest organizations in the entire world. They have so much wealth, and I mean, just even the $33,000 a month is small. It's just a drop in the bucket for them. But the fact that there are homeless around Vatican City so shows you just how much are they, I mean, I'm sure they do help the community there, but are they actually really helping as much as they could? Probably not. And I could stand corrected on that, or sit corrected, I guess. But but still, let's not blame McDonald's for the homeless problem in Vatican City or in Rome. I mean, that's just such a foolish thing to say when you're one of the most wealthy organizations where you actually have a bigger, more wealth and bigger coffers in some countries.
Yeah, and the other thing too is they obviously had to get approval to put it there. It didn't just show up overnight. I mean, somebody within the organization said, yeah, you can build it there, and this is how much you have to pay us. So I don't know why. Maybe he's not getting a cut. Maybe that's why he's mad.
McDonald's seems like it's actually very accommodating toward homeless people. I mean, I've seen a lot of McDonald's where people are allowed to put their carts in the front entry, and they're allowed to sit indoors for a good portion of the day so they're not cold during the winter. So, I mean, and I think they even give out free coffees to a lot of those people. So,
and they have
talking about the homeless, helping out the homeless.
And they have a terrifying cast of characters. They're the Hamburglar.
Yeah.
Ronald McDonald.
Yeah.
What's the purple guy?
Is he supposed to be like a chicken nugget or something?
I thought he had something to do with grapes. But I don't know. Grimly? Is that his name?
Is there somebody so long, named that? Yeah.
There's a whole cast of characters there, and I think it's kind of gone away over time, but because the clowns are a little scary. And you know, because there used to be commercials where you know the Ronald McDonald clown would come up and talk to the kids, but I don't think anybody wants that.
Yeah, I think they used to have their own TV show, too, for a little while. Because growing up, we had like pillows of the different characters. I think my brother had the Hamburglar. but there's actually an NHL goalie in Ottawa. He put the Hamburglar on his helmet.
Ah.
On the artwork. Mm-hmm. And they call him the Hamburglar. And he could get free McDonald's for the rest of his life.
That's smart.
Yeah. Because, I mean, it's like product placement.
He could go to the Vatican and say, do you know who I am?
Yeah.
I want a free burger. Do you know who you're talking to? Yeah. The Hamburglar. I wasn't really sure what they were trying to advocate. Were we supposed to steal hamburgers? Like, he's a hero for the children. He steals the burgers.
I don't think he's a Robin Hood. I think the clown fights the hamburger.
They're like,
and he wins.
He's like the bad guy in the situation.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and then the grape guy comes along and helps Ron McDonald, I think, or
something like that. That.
Yeah.
Huh. Maybe somebody remembers.
Maybe the grape guy is playing both sides. Yeah. Whatever's most convenient.
The mystery of McDonald's. So that's an interesting new one that you can go to there if you're over in the Vatican area. You can stop by the Mickey D's. They said they have some just down the road. I mean, and Burger King, and they've got them all there. It's just this one happens to be on Vatican-owned property, and I think that's kind of the issue.
Yeah, well, and plus McDonald's in America, it's fast food king, but in other countries, it's actually more of like a gourmet style restaurant, like in Israel. People go there when they want to have like a nice meal, and it's all because of the laws. It's actually beef from Israel, and everything's like natural products. So it's not the same in every country. It's a little different.
Yeah, we went to one in Ireland, and it had Irish beef, and it was actually pretty good. I mean, I don't know if it was good for you necessarily, but it tasted more like real food as opposed to some of the ones we have here in the U.S. And they are different in different restaurants or different places around the world. The Key of David program is coming up here in a bit on KPCG. Listen for that. A couple of episodes today. Also, the Trumpet Daily Radio Show with your host, Brad McDonald, today, filling in for Stephen Fleury from Edstone, England. Talked a lot about President Obama's legacy, and not a great one, a legacy of lawlessness. And he points out that moving forward, it doesn't too much matter who gets in. It's still the same sort of lawlessness that's been made popular over the last 8 years. You know, if I can't do it by the laws in the books, I'll just do it my own way. You know, if Congress won't act, I will. And made that sort of thinking popular. And so, really interesting program today on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show, and you can hear that here in a bit on KPCG, or the archives are online at kpcg.fm. Here's a really interesting story for you. You guys can put your lawyer hats on. What would be a lawyer hat, by the way? Top hat?
Probably a book.
A book.
Fedora.
Yeah, fedora. It's just an interesting story. This is from ABC. Family sues Apple, the corporation, claiming FaceTime distracted a driver in a crash that killed their 5-year-old daughter. And so it's a Texas couple, and what happened is a guy was driving. He was using the FaceTime app on his phone, wasn't paying attention, crashed into their car, killed their 5-year-old daughter. So they're suing Apple. I don't know if the driver was involved in the lawsuit, but it's more towards Apple. Obviously, Apple has money. And they say that at the time of the collision in question, the iPhone utilized by the driver contained the necessary hardware to be configured with software to automatically disable or lock out the ability to use FaceTime driving at a speed. I think he was going highway speed. However, Apple failed to configure the iPhone to automatically lock out the ability to utilize FaceTime while driving at highway speeds. So that's the lawsuit. What do you think about that?
Seems like a pretty good one that they have a good chance of winning to me.
Is it, what do you think? I mean, these are always interesting cases to me because it was negligence on the part of the person using the product. You know, and I don't know, maybe the company has responsibility there, but I mean, it's almost the same as saying, well, there's a car crash, so you sue Ford. Well, I don't know. I mean, maybe if the car they made didn't work, and I guess you could say that about the iPhone, like it had this problem, but the iPhone's not designed to be used while driving, even though people do use it while driving. Yeah. But it kind of is, too, because they have Google Map. It's murky to me. I don't know.
Yeah, I think this could be set a really big precedent. I don't know. Maybe Apple has their bases covered with some kind of legal agreement where they're not responsible for certain uses of their apps. I don't know if there's some kind of legal write-up they already have for that. But I think it's an interesting case because obviously just because something's available doesn't mean you should use it in certain situations. So I think... and Apple, they even have safeguards against that, like you mentioned, except it failed to configure. Now, I think that's not the company's fault. That would be more of the driver's fault. Because if the people suing Apple do win, does that mean every single technology provider have to create safeguards for every possible situation in case something goes wrong? That's basically what they're demanding. And that's unreasonable, and it takes away the responsibility of the user to not make foolish decisions and to have responsible behavior. But I mean, it does also bring up the problem of an iPhone, where you have so much technology at your fingertips that it is distracting to someone driving. And maybe I don't know. It's just I think the fault should be on the human, not on the technology given to the human. But at the same time, they do open up a gray area.
Well, and you could say also, do you want to build in something that automatically shuts it off at that speed? What if your car can't stop and you're going at a high rate of speed? That has happened, and you need to contact somebody and tell them, I can't stop my car. You need to call 911, but you can't because your phone's locked out. What then? Now do you there are so many instances that come up, and that's why it's so, I don't know. I would hate to be somebody that had to try to decide these types of things. I feel terrible for the people. I mean, I hope they do get some sort of, it seems like they should get something for the accident, obviously, and that nothing's going to bring their daughter back at this time. So I feel really bad for them, but it opens up a lot of interesting arguments legally for, like you say, technology companies. And if you make a certain technology, are you responsible for the way people use it, even if they misuse it?
I don't think it has so much to do with the way that people use it, but if you do claim as a company to have safeguards that will work and then they fail, then you've already put yourself out there and said that this is potentially our fault. If our safeguards don't work, you know, that can cost a life. I think Apple would be better off not even claiming to have safeguards like that, and then it's clearly not their problem if someone uses a device the way they choose, and the product never malfunctions. It's just the person choosing to use it in a wrong way.
Yeah, I guess I'm a little, I don't know the details, so I'm a little confused on whether you have to do that, whether you, or is it just an option? Like, you can turn it on, or,
yeah,
or does it have to come on? Because I think, as far as I know, it's an option. And so, you know, there's a story, not nearly as severe as this, because this involved the death, but the McDonald's lady, right? Even Arby's makes fun of that, because, you know, she got the hot coffee, she burned herself, and whatever. So I remember talking to, actually, a lawyer about that, just a general conversation, and he... you know, I said, well, it doesn't seem like she should get all that money, because she sued, and I think she won a lot of money. But he came on the other side and said, well, no, because in order to make the company, the big companies make a change, you've got to hit them hard. So even though maybe she didn't technically deserve all the money, it made a statement to make the company change some policies. It seems like it's just when you get into the legal systems of man, they get murky. And but it's an interesting question. So I thought it was an interesting story.
Well, why would Apple make it an option for someone to turn it off? Because then you're just relying on someone's self-discipline. And really, anytime they decide to use FaceTime in the car while driving, they could just use it.
Yeah, but I would think, and I don't know, but I would think as a parent, you maybe turn it off for your kids. Like, mm-hmm. maybe that's something. I just don't know enough about like the legality or how that works. I've had iPhones over the years, and I've never had anything where it turns off at a certain speed that I'm aware of, like automatically. Mm-hmm. But maybe there was more to that. I don't know. But the case, I mean, the obvious thing is, hey, don't be distracted while you're driving. You shouldn't be on that anyway. But is it Apple's responsibility? That's the question.
It would make sense to get rid of all visual aspects of the phone while driving, and then only make it possible to call, like, or to receive phone calls, things like that. Because, I mean, even texting, that requires looking at the screen to do it, or watching a video of any kind, or trying to read an article. Whatever people are doing on their phones, you could conceivably, as a technology company, block those aspects, but still make it possible for audio aspects that you need. Like, if you're driving and you want to listen to a podcast, you don't have to look at the screen. Or if you wanted to take a phone call or, you know, send out a phone call, then you could do that.
It's going to be interesting. I think, I mean, enough of these things will probably come up where they're going to have to do something about it and cover their bases one way or the other.
Yeah, I think the bigger thing is I don't want technology regulating human behavior. That's up to the people to regulate our behavior. And if we create technology to tell us what's right and wrong, what we can and cannot do, I think that misses the whole point, where as a human being, you should take responsibility and decide, oh, this is a good thing to do, this is a bad thing to do. And even if technology is capable of something, you should have the self-control not to do it. Just like, I know people who read books when they drive. They don't have a phone, but they get distracted anyway by reading books. So it's a behavioral problem of people. It's not the technology. Technology makes it easier for sure and more distracting, but I think it's a personal behavior problem.
Yeah, it's a really good point. I was thinking about reading and driving, you know, because they have all the like the warnings, don't text and drive. You imagine driving on the road, if that was an actually big issue, which it's not a big issue, but you look up at a billboard and says, you know, stop reading and driving. Like, but I am. I just read the billboard. It's impossible. It's impossible to warn you.
Yeah.
You have to read it. Here's another one that ties in with that. This is from Jacksonville. Truckers' road rage getting worse, not better, they say. Jacksonville-based truckers say if people better understood the challenges of driving 18-wheelers, they'd be less inclined to spar with them on the roads. They're getting cut off, all kinds of things. And then people are actually starting to shoot sometimes at the truck drivers. One guy got killed. And so the truck drivers are saying, well, we want guns in the cab to protect ourselves. Trucks are, you know, hey, I always give them plenty of room because, I do realize that they can't brake like a car. They can't, you know, just stop on a dime. You have to give them room. And it can be irritating, but at the same time, they're doing a service that we all need, and you have to give them room. But so in any event, some of them want guns now while they're driving trucks, which is just going to be a volatile situation. And they say one thing that they can all agree on, though, is that the road rage in general is getting worse towards them and towards other people. And they say it's related to two things that are growing more prevalent, more traffic, and texting while driving. The guy says nobody's paying attention. He drives truck all the time. He sees people just all over the road looking at their phones. Mm-hmm. He sees it everywhere. And so that ties into that. And then it leads to accidents and road rage, and on it goes.
Yeah, it's even just driving around here in Oklahoma City and Edmond, you still see it even after more stringent laws coming down just last year, I think, 2016. They had new fines for people texting while driving, but still see it all the time, and especially when you're driving a truck. I mean, any vehicle can be dangerous, but especially a huge truck where the cargo is very valuable, and that your vehicles, you can kill people very easily, cause a lot of problems, and people aren't paying attention to you. That's a huge problem, and it's just, I think there's a big failure in, well, if it's young people, parents teaching their kids not to do that. Now, not always their fault, but I think that's a big one. And then this very inadequate driving training.
Yeah.
In most states where you don't really need to know that much to get your license and to start driving. I think that's another big problem.
Well, that's, I mean, I said, you know, I always try to pay attention to the truckers, and it's because my dad told me to when I was growing up. He said, hey, they can't stop. They can't move like you can. You've got to really watch out. And, you know, obviously if you make a mistake, you lose.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
But like this truck driver said, he said, look, if we've got a jam on the brakes, he said it can cause a dysfunction in the braking system. It can shift the truck's load out of balance. You know, they're not carrying a week's worth of groceries in the trunk. They're hauling a lot of stuff. And if that shifts or has problems, it can be dangerous. So anyway, yeah, be careful out there. All kinds of distractions when people are driving. Abraham, you've got an interesting story for us here. This is about Mein Kampf. I think yours is from the Jerusalem Post. I had a headline about it too from Yahoo. Hitler's Mein Kampf becomes German bestseller. They did a small print run and it sold, and now they're on their sixth print run, I believe.
Yes.
Seems like you shouldn't maybe print that one again, but they are, and it's a bestseller.
Yeah, this is a really interesting argument developing in Germany because obviously the copyright became void. That the previous owner had, the German government, they chose not to buy it back. So someone privately bought it and then they're reproducing it. However, it's...
Do they know who privately bought it? Or is,
yes. Yeah, I forget. It's some kind of a historical society. Okay. It's so... and the main point of why they're publishing isn't because they like Hitler. It's because they think that by showing people his ideas and how destructive they were, we can avoid the same problems, because every reproduction of it has notes from scholars and historians showing what happened based on his beliefs, why things in there are crazy. And so it's not just the text that has a lot of commentary with it showing why it's so demented. It's just interesting because you do want people to be educated on why things happen, but at the same time, you shouldn't reproduce something that's poisons society so much and just has a chance of rekindling a lot of terrible ideas.
Yeah, I agree with what you said there, because there's plenty of history written about what Hitler did and some of the things. Do you need to get into the mind of a madman to realize it's not right? And I think that it'd be like looking at, say, and they do this, like looking at a really horrible film and being like, oh, we've got to look at this just to like understand how bad it is. Well, what if we just don't look at it anymore? Wouldn't it be better? You shouldn't ignore that history, obviously, but I don't know that you need to read, you know, that'd be like, do you listen to his speeches all day just to keep a historical perspective? I don't want to hear what he has to say.
Yeah, there are plenty of books about Hitler that give in-depth analysis into his mindset from people who are very close to him. You don't have to read his exact perspective, because the risk there is actually starting to sympathize with him a little bit.
Well, and the other thing is too, you know, they can say, well, people are, let me just say it this way. They don't know why people are buying it. How do you know why people buy it? You know, they may not be looking at it for the historical notes. Maybe they just want to read what he said. So there'd be no way to gauge that.
Yeah. And I mean, it is interesting if we think about it, because this is just in Germany. Mein Kampf is available anywhere else in the world. Any library you go in the United States, you'll have several copies of it. So the main concern about this is just in Germany, because of obviously the history there. And I have a quote from one of those books Grant mentioned about Hitler. It's by Peter Watson. He's a scholar on German history. And I think this is interesting to consider And he talks about why Hitler wrote it and what's in Mein Kampf, because not that someone would believe the same mysticism and religion that's in Mein Kampf, but if you look at what Hitler actually talks about, it's actually not too far-fetched from what people are already saying in Germany. And he's a really good quote here. Hitler wrote Mein Kampf when he was in jail in Germany after his failed the Munich Putsch of 1923. That's my best German there.
It was adequate.
Thank you.
it didn't sound like much of an English accent or anything like Canadian accent.
I'll see that as a victory then.
Yes.
So what Mein Kampf is, besides, he has a lot of things in there about extreme Darwinism and some religion in Germany at the time there were lots of movements. This was a very popular thing he was writing about. Today for us it seems crazy, but back then it was very popular. But the main thing is how he thinks about history, and here's the quote from Peter Watson. To learn history, he explained, this is Hitler, means to seek and find the forces which are the causes leading to those effects which we subsequently perceive as historical events. One of these forces, he felt, was that Britain, France, and Russia were intent on encircling Germany, and thereafter never rid himself of this view. For him, history was invariably the work of great men. His heroes were Charlemagne, Rudolf von Habsburg, Frederick the Great, Peter the Great, Napoleon, Bismarck, and Kaiser Wilhelm the First. And so just one more line here. For Hitler, history was a catalog of racial struggles, although the outcome always depended on great men. So for Hitler, he believed that history was great men coming to power, and especially for him as a German, believing that France, Russia, and Great Britain were trying to encircle and bring down Germany. And if you look at his heroes, Charlemagne, the Habsburgs, Bismarck, Napoleon, and those are a lot of the same names lots of people in Europe, especially German politicians, some of them looked up to as the heroes of the European Union, of Europe. And so it is just interesting to contrast the ideas, if not that dissimilar.
Yeah. I mean, what's the struggle in Europe today? It's a racial struggle with the immigration, and they're lacking a great leader, as I think a lot of people would see it. They need somebody to step to the forefront and make some decisions, and Angela Merkel's not that person right now. So it's exactly the same.
Yeah.
It's a racial struggle. Germans aren't upset with their German neighbor. They're upset with the Muslim that's come into their country, and maybe others, but that's the real push right now. So very interesting. Yeah, I mean, it is. That's not different. That's not different at all from what's happening today. But it is easy to look at the black and white film and think, that guy with the funny mustache, you know, that'll never happen again. But the ideologies, even though, like you say, they are different with some aspects of it, at their core, they are very similar. Because what did Germany want? More room, more space, to dominate.
Yeah.
Well, that's not that much different than today.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's something to always keep in mind with Germany as a... I think Gerald Fleury wrote in the latest Trumpet that's coming out about how unified Germany, no matter what period of time, is always dangerous. And a big reason for that is because Hitler didn't make up these ideas. He got them from people before him who had the same ideas. And it's not just Hitler coming to power and changing Germany. These ideas have been in Germany since it was created under Charlemagne. And they're institutionalized inside of Germany, and they persist inside of Germany. They may take on different names, they may look more sophisticated, but they're the same. And I think that's what people don't understand about German culture. And now that's not true for all Germans, but I think in government, in religion, in intellectual Germany, it's very much the same as the old Germany that really started the two world wars. And so... Hitler wasn't just a madman, of course he was, but he was also a product of that period's education and ideas. And when you have that viewpoint, you start to see just how dangerous his ideas are, because they're actually not that new or unique. They're something that's been common throughout European history.
Yeah, that's Hitler's Mein Kampf. It's the German. It becomes a bestseller in Germany. Interesting. Grant, you've got a final story for us here today from the College Fix. Finally, they're getting to the bottom of some real issues here. Male college students to undergo critical self-reflection of masculinity.
Here we go.
It's about time. Isn't it about time?
After all these years, we're finally getting what we need. Yeah, this is from the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
Of course it is.
I'm sorry to say. And they're starting up a six-week program in February that aims to counter the alleged harmful effects of society's masculinity paradigms and pressures. And they also want to empower participants to promote gender equity. They also say that they have a transformative model of social justice allyship. So right there, you know that it's going to be a corrupted course whenever you're talking about social justice.
The same school that has the anti-white class. I forget exactly what the title was, but
Isn't it the problem with whiteness?
Yeah, the problem with white. You could. That's your. You know, what are you taking this spring there, Bill? Well, the problem with whiteness and critical self-reflection on masculinity.
Sounds like an art class. The problem of whiteness.
Yeah. They're really coming up with some interesting classes there. And you have to pay money for them. That's the thing. What kind of a degree do you get with that?
I have no idea. Yeah, they're discussing all these topics like media and pop culture, vulnerability. You know, we need to develop far more velvet than steel, of course, as they think. And they're going to talk about sexuality, hookup culture, alcohol, relationships, and violence. And they do bring up a couple of decent points, actually, about how alcohol abuse among men and depression and a couple of problems with romantic life can be issues for men in college more than they are with women in a lot of cases. And even the fact that fewer men are going to college than women, that can be an issue. But the way they're trying to address it is by changing the way that a man fundamentally views and reacts to life.
Well, yeah, I think a lot of those problems occur because they've gone halfway down the path of destroying what manhood should be and is. And so they say, well, there's problems here. Why don't we go all the way down the path instead of heading back the direction that you came from to solve the problems? They're just going further down the path to more problems. I mean, as a male, which we are, all three of us, can you imagine going to a class like this? Talk about, especially if you went into it with, you know, you were just kind of wide-eyed and, hey, what do they have to say? And you didn't really have any strong belief on anything. I think you come out of there pretty confused about life in general. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wouldn't want to take it. Other than to maybe make a couple of jokes.
Yeah. Well, it just reminds me, I've just been reading a lot about George Washington lately and listening to David McCullough talk about him. And if I were to listen to David McCullough talk about George Washington as a man and then go to that class, I'd be so confused at what a man is supposed to be. But then look to George Washington, who did some amazing things, but he's the exact opposite of what most intellectuals think a man should be. It would just be so confusing because there isn't proof to back up what they're saying masculinity should be.
I mean, really what they're saying, if you want to just kind of condense it down, is men should be women, right?
Mm-hmm.
They're just trying. I mean, that's what they're saying. If you talk about like, well, you need to be more vulnerable and more this and more that. What, you mean like a woman, right? They should just call it how to be a woman.
Well, they're talking about stereotypes in pop culture where the hero of a movie is a man who is very, very strong and deals with things in a rational, kind of a cold and heartless manner because something needs to get done. But at the same time, they're saying that is very destructive for men to view. And then they have movies coming out like Ghostbusters and other movies where all of the heroes or the heroines are feminists. And it's trying to make it like they, you know, both genders are exactly the same.
You know, really, the best education you probably get there would be to sign up for the opposite class. Like, if all the men signed up for the women's lib classes and then the women signed up for this one, like, you'd learn actually how to fulfill your
role.
And
then just apply it to yourself.
Yeah,
right.
Or just reverse it. You know, like, oh, okay, well, I'll just do the opposite of what you said and it'll probably work out okay. yeah, really strange. It's an attack. It's been going on for a long time. There's a good write-up at thetrumpet.com, a booklet on a couple of them. Attack on fatherhood, and then there's also the redefining family as well. It just keeps going and going and going, and it seems like every day there's a story about a major university coming up with just some crazy idea for a class, and you'd come out of there very confused.
Yeah, this is part of an alarming trend across the entire country that is fighting men, and especially by far white men, and they're trying to purge male students of what they call toxic masculinity, something that apparently is a detriment to not just themselves, but everyone around them. They even have that term now, mansplaining, where if you're a man and you happen to explain something in a helpful manner, you're being condescending and you're now mansplaining, not explaining something.
Wow, that's new to me. I didn't know that one.
That's literally the dumbest word I've ever heard, so it's probably not worth knowing.
That was very good mansplanation of that.
So. Yeah, you're doing it right now. How dare you? You've offended all of us. So you're supposed to say it in a convoluted way, and that would be better? Or, like, I don't understand that question.
No, it's just if you have a mind to help a female, nothing you say is then edifying or helpful at all, because
I see.
Women don't need your help, basically.
I gotcha. It's who you're talking to.
Right.
Yeah, you run into that sometimes in various situations, like going into a public place and you open a door for somebody. Mm. And most times people are very like, oh, thank you. You know, but sometimes they give you the eyeball. Oh, sorry. But, you know, most people are pretty nice about that sort of thing. I think on these university campuses, they're kind of in their own little bubble. I mean, even though it is affecting a lot of people in society, the extreme ideas that they're pushing, I think a lot of people don't even really, subscribe to those just right. in day-to-day
Completely
life.
Completely absurd.
Yeah, because they're just crazy.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's why a lot of college graduates don't get jobs when they leave college, because, I mean, if you learn about that for 8 years and you come get a job, I mean,
oh, exactly.
It doesn't have any context in society.
All you'd be qualified to do is to teach that class.
Yeah.
Which kids would be just intolerable to work with, too.
Oh, yeah, for sure. You know, if your boss came up to you and said, hey, I'm going to need you to do this, you're mansplaining. Okay.
You're fired. How about that?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, man. It's a crazy world out there. That's all we have time for today. And thanks for joining us here on this Tuesday edition of Trumpet Radio Live. Make sure you listen for the Key of Day program, Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Those are coming your way here in just a bit. Thanks for joining us today. Myself, Dwight Falk, Grant Turch, and Abraham Blondo. Have a great rest of your Tuesday. We'll see you tomorrow.
You're listening to Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG.